You are listening to KHSU. I invite you to thoughtfully listen to the following program, Relationships to Racism. We're in a group of thoughtful and competent women who live and work in Humboldt County discuss their relationships to racism. Racism has always existed within the human race. To treat someone differently or unfairly simply because they belong to a different, quote-unquote, ethnic community or nationality or even a different religion seems to be perhaps one of our greatest challenges. Perhaps after listening to this program, you will feel ready to look deeper within and challenge some of your own deepest implicit biases. Put yourself in the place of our guests today and imagine how you would live your life in their shoes. There is more value to having racism interpreted and defined by the people and groups it affects and not the group in power. I'm Danielle Orr, and the panel is comprised of Sarah Lindgren, Akana, of Yurok descent, Renee Salcedo, former director of diversity at College of the Redwoods. Renee is Latino and heads the local organization Centro del Pueblo. Maya, a Black professional woman and mother. Jill Larrabee, a member of the NAACP. Zira Starchild, also a Black woman and mother of two biracial children. Alice Walker said this, "If you want to have a life worth living, a life that expresses your deepest feeling and emotions and your cares and your dreams, you have to fight for it." Let's join our guests in that fight for equality. And maybe what we can do to begin is go around the table, starting with you, and say what you'd like to say about racism, actually, and maybe in a more global sense, and then we'll bring it down to our local area.
Well, I very much appreciate us having this conversation. I feel in the several years that I've lived here in Humboldt County that people are somewhat scared and feel threatened by even having this conversation. So I really appreciate us doing this. I'm originally from San Francisco, grew up there, was very fortunate in that I was always surrounded by people of color, communities of color, and fortunately throughout my life I got used to that. I got used to living in a multicultural place where we all acknowledge that we had a unique place in the history of this country, that we had unique cultural contributions to make, and that we had the right to enjoy our cultural experience. And then I moved to Humboldt, and it was much more difficult. It was much more difficult moving from that kind of setting to one where there is a culture of what I call colorblindness. That people, for fear of sounding racist or discriminating in some way, fall back on this concept of colorblindness, which, in my view, is worse because it denies me who I am and the experience that I bring. So I'll give you an example. Here in Humboldt, just, you know, we're just talking about how racism manifests in general, right? I've noticed that communities of color and women of color, that we receive no deference as far as our experience, and therefore no deference around how to resolve the injustices or the suffering. I was shocked that there were so many organizations telling me and my community how we should be feeling, how we should run our own organizations, what kinds of policies we should be pushing for, etc. Instead of supporting and empowering and respecting our community enough to defer to our experience and what we believe would cause the changes. And then the second area that I just wanted to mention that has been very difficult for me, because I've always been a fighter around racial justice and social justice, is that people here, more than where I previously lived, although this exists everywhere, right? who's kidding who? It exists everywhere, and the Bay Area is no sanctuary for racism. But it's just more blatant, I have found here, that those of us who speak out against the racism, we are villainized. We are told, oh my goodness, you're getting angry? You're blowing up. You're the angry woman of color. And I've lost 2 jobs here in Humboldt County. I mean, I was terminated twice because of that, because I expressed my views. I countered the mainstream culture around how to talk about race and racism. And, you know, as you can see, even by the way I look, I'm very non-threatening. I just happen to be a brown woman. And I've been treated, generally speaking, of course, I have a network and a community of allies, but in general, it's been very exhausting and difficult for me and my family to be villainized in that way and to be treated as if I were crazy or somehow inappropriate. So those are a couple of themes that I would throw out around racism in general and how a woman of color has perceived it here in Humboldt County.
How about you? Would you like to talk a little bit about your definition of racism?
I'm a white woman. And as a white woman, before white people in general can really talk about racism, we need to accept and have accountability for who we are and what our ancestors created and what whiteness is and what white supremacy is and how that is affecting us today, but also in our past. And it's a lot of internal work, and a lot of people would rather get distracted by television and feel good and justify, well, oh, that's not everywhere, versus doing the inside work. And I think that's one of the main problems that happens in especially Humboldt County in nonprofits, where there's well-meaning white folks that want to do the work, but then do a lot of damage to people with telling them they're angry and not really allowing people to have their emotions. I'm an emotional and passionate person my whole life, and I've seen injustice since I was born, and it just...
upsetting to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it should be for everyone. And that's one of the things actually that's very frustrating as a white person, to hear another white person justifying why they care. There's no reason why you shouldn't care. If you're a human being and you're on this planet, you care. And, you know, just because you know somebody that happens to be a certain color and now all of a sudden you care, or, you know, with gun violence or however, we just always need to justify. No, we're in this together. We're in a community. We need to love on each other. So within that, like, whiteness is really something that, to go off what Renee said, colorblindness, it's just another pass for white people to just keep, like, skiing through things. And I read this really great quote on Twitter, and they said, white people, you know, are really good at navigating the system until it comes to racism. Then they're at a loss. And it's true. And is it because the system was made for us? Obviously, you know, we're not good at navigating the system. We just get to skate by. So
that's a great way to get started.
I am a black woman. This is very personal for me because many years ago, I married a white man from Germany, blonde hair, blue eyed, and we had 2 beautiful kids that are, one just started college and the other is graduating from Arcata High this year. So racism is a personal thing for me, because when you have a biracial family, you totally forget about color. It's just, you know, you have beautiful babies. And we honestly moved to Humboldt because we thought that this was a progressive place and that this would be a safe place to raise biracial babies. But once my kids got into the school system, the first race incident we had was when my older daughter, who was 5 years old, was home from kindergarten and said that a little friend she played with all week was told that she couldn't play with her anymore because her parents said that whites should stay with whites and blacks should stay with blacks. And that was in a school in Fortuna in kindergarten. So that was my young daughter's experience learning about racism. And it was always awkward for us as, you know, parents who just, you know, we loved each other, we got married, to try to explain to a child something that didn't exist outside our home. Within our home, you were just a human being and you had feelings and you needed love and you needed a hug, and that's what we did. Outside of our home, she learned at 5 years old, there's this whole other world where my mommy is looked at different than my daddy. And, well, what am I? That's what both my kids said. So I remember telling them at that young age that the world is going to see you as black. My kids are half white. Once they got into the later public schools by middle school, they understood what I meant. That no matter how many people they told they were half white in this country, you don't get to claim you're half white. If you look black, you're black. And this is an issue that I have on the side about this whole thing about self-identification. I hear a lot of that in equity circles now, talk about how I racially self-identify. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but when you are black skin like me, it really doesn't matter what you self-identify. You walk in, the world sees you as black. You know what I'm talking about. And so for my kids, even though they are half white, they don't get that privilege. They get to be treated like black people. But from a larger context, my honest belief is that race is an illusion, that we are one family, the human race, and that racism is a cancer on the soul of the human race. And it has separated the human condition so that we are fractured as a people. And it hurts all of us. Not just those of us who may experience actual oppression, but even the oppressor is hurt by this. They're hurt in their soul. It's a psychological condition before it becomes a political and socioeconomic position.
Whew, your turn. About racism here on KHSU, relationships to racism in Humboldt County and beyond.
I do agree with the self-identification, the comment about you can see yourself however you want, but I always remind people of color, society sees you as black or brown. Okay, so you can call yourself what you want, but you will be treated as such, and these are the rules for survival in this black and brown bubble. And even though I'm in my 40s, there are times when I'm so busy, I forget what color I am, if that makes any sense, and I'm out and like, why are they doing this? Why is this? Damn it, I'm black. You know, like it's like, oh, I forgot about that. And so I have to readjust because I live in this system, and I get really upset when people say things like, oh, why would you live in Ferndale? Don't you feel uncomfortable there? I feel uncomfortable in the United States of America, right? So it's not Ferndale. It's not Humboldt County. It's not Arcata. It's not a job that you work at, right? It's the United States and the system that we've created. And I'm hoping I don't cry a lot today, but this is the first week where I've met a person who's in their mid-20s, and they can pass as white, but they are biracial, and their family did not do them any favors in preparing them for this is how society will see you. And having to look at that person and say, yeah, so you're going to have to learn how to leave some parts of yourself at home if you want to survive in a job, in a school. You can't bring all of you somewhere and stay safe. And trying to explain racism and microaggressions to someone that has no concept of it, because in their home, that's not what was taught. That's not how they lived. And it's just so heartbreaking to explain that to someone. So I'm glad we are doing this, because it's such a painful topic. It's not about being politically correct. It's not about someone being offended. Yes, people may respond in anger to racism, but there's a lot of pain there. It's not anger. We only have certain words to describe what's happening, but there is no way someone can understand what it feels like to be treated differently just because of the way you look. There's nothing you can do about that. So I'm glad we're talking about this today.
And how about you, Sarah? Would you like to talk about what racism is to you? And you're on the phone, so thank you for bearing with us. And please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. To continue that idea of self-identification and what that means, you know, I'm a light-skinned Yurok woman. My dad is not light-skinned. My sister is not light-skinned. You know, my dad's side of the family is not. You look at them, you know, they're brown. And for me, you know, growing up here, there was that concept, you know, when I was a kid. I don't know if they still talk about it that much to youth, because I am not in school anymore, but I know when I was growing up, there was that concept of success in both worlds. You know, we heard that a lot when I was a child. And for me, it was just that phrase was so real, because when I would leave my home, when I would go into school, when I would go out into the community, you know, I got to be where it was just easier to, like the woman before me was just saying, leave pieces of yourself at home, because it's not safe out there. When you give people information or you let them into that delicate part of your life, which is your culture, your family, the things that you hold dearest to you, they're not going to treat it gently. You know, they're going to exploit it. They're going to use it to hurt you. You know, it was always just easier not to talk about that. I haven't had the luxury of being able to do that much, but there are certain times when I can. And even the small things in life, you know, my two sons are dark also. When we go out somewhere, you know, I watch them walk into a store ahead of me, and I watch clerks follow them. And they don't treat me that way, but they treat my children that way. You know, this is something that I hear people in town talk about, that it's something that's new, you know, or that it's coming to a head because of recent elections in the country and things like that. And to me, it's always been this way. This isn't new. This has been this way since, was it 1776, when the Spanish first came here? They made contact with my village. They erected that cross up on Trinidad Head, which is one of, you know, the most important places to my village, and declared that that town was now Trinidad. You know, that's when racism started for us, was in the late 1700s. And so the idea that somehow things are now coming to a head, well, I think they've always been here. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. But I think that, you know, we have an opportunity to address it and to talk about it in an honest way. And I'm so grateful that this program is happening and that we're all able to talk about it now, because I think it is such an important time. And, you know, we can make a difference in this community and hopefully make things easier on our children, because, you know, things have to get better.
There's a lot of note-taking going on, so maybe we'll go around the table again and you can address some of the notes that you're making. You're listening to KHSU, and right before we go around and do those notes, why don't we go ahead and tell the listeners who you are?
Hi, my name is Renee Saucedo, and I have the honor of being an organizer with the National Union of Healthcare Workers, and I'm also a volunteer member of Centro del Pueblo, a grassroots organization that serves undocumented families here in Humboldt County.
And?
My name is Jill Larrabee, and I'm an organizer for Show Up Humboldt, which is an anti-racist community group out here, and also the education chair of the Eureka NAACP.
I'm Zira Starchild, and I don't really consider myself an activist. I'm a Black woman and a mother, and it was the death of Josiah Lawson and watching his mother, Charmaine, come up here every month for 10 months begging for justice for her son that has brought me out to become a public person speaking on this.
I am Maya. I have a private practice. I do therapy.
Great. And on the telephone?
I'm Sarah Lindgren-Akana. I am a Yurok woman from the Churai village in Trinidad, and I too don't consider myself any kind of activist or anything, but it was also the murder of Josiah Lawson that kind of changed my ideas on speaking out about racism, because I didn't feel safe before, and I thought that by trying to not address it, by trying to just move around it, that we were keeping ourselves safe. And with his murder, I realized that, you know, it is like a cancer, and by not addressing it, by not treating it, we let it grow.
Thank you. Let's hear some notes.
Yeah, I've been jotting down some notes, hearing my sisters speak. And the first thing that comes to mind is you just feel the power here, right, in this group of women. I mean, we're talking about what we experience as women of color in Humboldt, but mainly I think that collectively we represent what is possible, right? How things can change because of the courage and the experience and the wisdom of women that we have here around the table and on the phone. One thing that I just wanted to say is that, you know, we can go on and on about personal stories about how individual racism manifests, you know, how I might be called an illegal or go back to your home country. And there's plenty of that. And yes, here in Humboldt, we do need to have conversations and trainings on racial bias and white supremacy and microaggressions based on race and what those things mean, because many of us experience those on a daily basis. But I also wanted to highlight the fact that I think that an even more egregious form of racism is the structural racism that is also about maintaining power and control, right? When people say, oh, well, you know, we're a majority white community, so that's why all our elected officials or people in power who claim to speak for us are there. And so my question is, well, the communities of color, we're growing and growing. At some point soon, we're going to reach about 50% of our population. Like the rest of the state, will no longer be the quote-unquote minority that we are referred to. And so there's no excuse for the white community or the community of European descent to have all the power, to have all the control. For example, to hold the purse strings around, you know, who gets money to do social work and who doesn't, right? Who abides by their notion of what is appropriate and what strategies to use and which ones aren't worthy of resources and funding to do our work. And I put out my organization as an example, Centro del Pueblo. We work with undocumented families. We don't get a dime from local foundations, not a penny. And, you know, we're not a radical organization, but we speak truth to power. And we tell the powers that be what our experience is in this region. And they don't like to hear it, but that's tough. You know, we've got to do it anyway in order for things to change. We have to tell our stories. So it's about power and control. And so I want to speak to those people who are not guilty of that individual racism. I would never do that to Zira's children, right? I would never say anything like that despicable. And yet, these are the people who still have the power in this county and have control over decision making, over resources, and are not sharing it with communities of color and are not having these conversations with the women of color at this table. So I really want us to think about that face of racism in Humboldt County. It's structural. It's historical. Yes, it continues to be at a personal level. But people who are claiming to be against racism, they need to look at their role as far as how they are complicit in holding the power and control. It's an extension of, you know, colonization. And I don't use that word lightly. It's colonization. It's just the 2018 version.
To dovetail off what Renee is saying as a white woman and as exactly what she's saying, is like it's talking about the systems. And as a white person who gets to have that privilege and that power, who actually removes herself from power systems, but we need to personally change our thinking, decolonize our thoughts, and really focus on the fact that the whiteness is what Zero is saying, a cancer. It's a culture. It's some kind of cult that we've created that's infected us. And so when you can personally internalize and get right with that, then you can go into these systems and these structures of power and make change. But the problem is, especially in Humboldt County, the people that are in power, that are well-intentioned white people, are the ones that are doing the damage, and I see it daily. And they claim to be anti-racist folks. They haven't done the internal work. They haven't done the reading. They haven't spoken to the people in the room of color. They haven't befriended. They don't even know how to interact with people of color. I'm getting angry. I'm gonna stop.
I'd like to say something to what Renee said about power. According to the 2016 census, California is 49% white now, which means it is 51% minority. and I'm doing the quote unquote thing, because that is how we have been trained to define ourselves. But from my understanding of it, if we were a public company on Wall Street, once you hit 51%, you have a majority stake. But clearly, if you look at the systems of power from the state capital down to even our local city council, look at the police department, look at the DA's office, even in Humboldt County, where it is 20% non-white, you don't see that balance of that demographic reflected in the power structure. If you look at most of the systems of power, they're usually somewhere like maybe 98% white. There's one or two folks of color in these offices. And the normalization of that, that makes even minorities used to that and not question of that, is something that I realize it's time to change, it's time to push. Because I think that that 2016 census is very telling about not just the present, but the future. In the Humboldt County school system, I forget what the numbers are, but they're actually, it's higher than 20% minorities currently now in our local schools. So you're looking at 10 years from now, the balance of power shifting even further, at least in terms of numbers. But is the actual balance of power going to change? Because if you have a minority, like say white South Africa used to be, where there was a minority that held the power and ruled, they had to rule through force. They had to rule through a sort of permanent military occupation, because that's the only way a minority can control things. And I'm wondering how this state that is already now 51% non-white, and yet the balance of power has not changed at all to reflect that. We don't share the power in that way. Project that 10 years further. How does the white dominant group hold on to that? And when I talk about the dominant group, I realize a lot of white folks, they are not meaning to be racist. But if I look, say, at our three local main papers, they are white-owned, white-run organizations. Renee talked about the foundations who offer folks money and decide who not to offer folks money. The two main foundations, I won't say their names, but I do know that they are white-run organizations. Every other system of power that you can think of locally, it's the same thing. So what we have is a community that is talking a great deal now about equity and fairness, that is very comfortable within its current climate of white people run everything, but we want to talk about equity. Well, that's not equity. That is not equity in action. That's just talk. In reality, nothing has changed except that it's now politically incorrect to say we want white people to run everything. So we don't say it. But our system has not changed. White people run everything. And the media domination, that's the important thing, which God bless KHSU that you guys exist, to give a chance for folks like us to present what in the larger corporate media world would be considered an alternative narrative. But I don't really think that there's anything alternative about what we're saying. I think people who listen to this are going to say these women are real. They're talking about the real world that we're living in. So the narrative that we're fed by corporate media, which is largely a white narrative, suggests that we're a democracy. We're represented equally. No, we've never been that. This is a democracy. It's hard to swallow it, but our founding fathers, the majority of them, were slave owners. So we have a democracy that was literally built on the backs of slavery and genocide. And from that birth, we have now, 2018, a culture that is trying to find its soul, because I think America wants to be this bastion of freedom and this bastion of equality, but we really can't reconcile how we came into existence. The real story of us and what we want to be aren't really in sync. Equality would change that.
Thoughts? Comments?
I was afraid that today someone would ask me, well, how do we solve this? And I was thinking, I don't have an answer. We can't solve it. But I do think we can demand equality. The counseling that I do is specifically for people with disabilities, and they have demanded equal treatment. So they have these Centers for Independent Living. That advisory board, you have to have 51% of people with disabilities on that board. You're not allowed to just monopolize it. I think we need to demand it. I don't know how, but yeah, we need to do that.
Renee?
And we are, and people are. And new organizations are forming in Humboldt, and new networks based on solidarity are being created. You know, it is completely unacceptable that Josiah Lawson had to die. It's completely mm-hmm. unacceptable that a black young man died because a local police department held certain assumptions about black men. It is completely unacceptable that our county sheriff tell undocumented families that he will not support them in their effort to create a sanctuary county. He has no understanding of their situation, yet tells them that he is doing it on their behalf. It is totally unacceptable that Native communities locally, Latino communities, and African American communities face racial profiling by local law enforcement on a daily basis. And I don't say this lightly. I say this because we hear the reports. Our organizations hear the reports directly from people who suffer it. It is still an abomination that indigenous people in our area are still fighting for things like sovereignty and being able to live on their own ancestral land without having to fight on a daily basis. So, you know, people can call us whatever they want. Are we upset about all these things? Of course we are. Why? Because we're loving, feeling human beings. How could we not be upset by all this? This is an issue of human rights. It's an issue of human dignity when we talk about racism in Humboldt County and in our country. It's about life and death for many of us. When my mother was deported a year ago, which traumatized me and my entire family, I saw the U.S. government in a whole different light even from before. The experiences I had had in this country as a Chicana. I thought, wow, they are not going to leave our families alone and will continue to scapegoat us based on racism. The only reason why my mother was deported is because we are Mexican. It's racism. It's the only reason why she was deported, forcibly separated from her family at the age of 83 with dementia. So when we have these conversations about race and racism, we join, you know, all oppressed communities who fight, whether they be workers for better decision making at their workplaces, women so that we don't have to be sexually harassed, youth so that we don't have to be treated like criminals, especially youth of color, and women of color, right, with all our intersectionalities. What we're saying with love and compassion is defer to our experience. Respect us enough to trust that this is what we live and this is what we're saying we need to do as a community to better the suffering and to combat the injustices.
Sarah, would you like to offer some comments or thoughts?
I wrote down some notes while Zero was talking because I think that, you know, she hit on some really good points. Something that came up for my family and the remaining descendants of the Churai village, which is where we're from, we formed a 501c3 nonprofit called the Churai Ancestral Society. I'm not representing them here today, but we have been working really hard to preserve and protect and maintain what's left of the undeveloped portion of our traditional village site. And there came a point with one of the last projects that the city of Trinidad approved where it was going to threaten the stability of a bluff that would then impact graves that are located below the bluff and village graves. And the descendants of the village ended up having a occupation of the lighthouse so that it wouldn't be moved to that location that would impact the bluff. And you know, while we were there, we were having discussions and negotiations and things like that to try to find an alternative location for that lighthouse to go. And something that came up that I had always had in the back of my mind, but I was actually shocked to hear, was not that people were so blind to the fact that racism was happening, but that they saw it. And although they didn't actively or overtly participate in it, they knew exactly what was going on. And I don't know if that makes sense or if it's a little too abstract, but, you know, sometimes when I'm dealing with this stuff through our organization or just in life, I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. When they say things to me or they do something like approve a project that's going to impact our cultural resources that are very important to us as tribal people or something like that, you know, I tend to try to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think, well, they just don't understand. It's about education, right? Because that's what the narrative was when I was growing up, that we need to just educate people. If they're educated, if we teach them about us, then they'll care about us and then they won't try to hurt us anymore. And that's, you know, what my grandfather spent his life doing. My grandfather was one of the first Native Americans to graduate from HSU, and he spent his whole life doing that, educating people. And even after all of that, I think he was born in, I want to say, 1917, and he spent his entire life trying to do that. And then here I come along, you know, his granddaughter, after my father did it, now I'm doing it. How many generations we have to go where we just continue to educate people, right? But the thing that came up was that they knew that it was racist, or they knew that it was based in racism to approve that project and that it impacted us in this negative way. And the question was, if we let them have this, meaning us, if we let them have this, if they win, where does it stop? Where do we draw the line? Do we just give them the whole country back? I think that's the actual fear. Is California 51% controlled by a minority, or that it's 51% minority? Well, I think that the fear is they don't want to be on the receiving end of the racism and the oppression that's been perpetuated all this time. And I think that the fear is that that's the way that we are going to treat dominant culture, that we will turn around and do to them what they did to us. And that's something that when I have conversations with people that, you know, they'll even identify into the conversation that they are racist. And it tends to be based in fear, or at least that's my personal experience. When I have that opportunity to have that honest conversation with someone, and it blows me away, because I think, you know, what about us and this entire time that you have known us, meaning Indigenous people, have we ever perpetuated racism against the dominant culture? We have always tried to figure out a way to get along. There was this book I read recently about a woman who was part of the formation of the American Indian Movement. And in it, she says, the only thing Indians fight for is to be left alone. We just want to be left alone so that we can manage our land, take care of our people, and protect our graves. That's all we've ever wanted. And, you know, I don't know if there's a way to address that fear that people have that's causing this racism, but I think it's an unrealistic fear. But I do want to acknowledge it, that I think that a lot of this stuff, you know, upholding of white supremacist values and benefiting from white privilege, but not actively engaging in dismantling the system that oppresses people of color, like, you're participating in that racism. You know, you're participating in the system that is holding someone else down. If you don't actively engage to dismantle that system, there's no such thing as being in the middle of the road when it comes to racism. You're either actively dismantling it or you're upholding it. There is no middle ground, because white people either benefit from it or they're dismantling it. You can't be on the sidelines with this. And if there's a fear that somehow we're going to retaliate or something if we're treated well, I just want to say that when that lighthouse moved, or when city council voted to move McKinley, that's opportunities for healing. That's opportunities for justice to start to happen. And that makes a community come together. People don't feel vengeance when healing starts to happen. And I can't even quite describe it, but it's a feeling that when we have those small victories, or we watch, you know, the Wiat tribe, when Eureka City Council made moves to try to give Indian Island back to the Wiat tribe, you know, that's courageous of City Council to do. And it was courageous of the Arcata City Council to vote to take down the McKinley statue. And we appreciate the efforts of everyone to get the lighthouse moved off of that last part of the Tri Village. And those symbolic gestures create opportunities for healing. They're not a threat to anyone. You know, it just means that now we can start to move forward and put some of that pain behind us and replace it with a sense of belonging, with a sense of community, with a sense that we matter too, and that we are here too, and that our pain is acknowledged.
This is a really good time for you listening to make some notes of your own, maybe thoughts you're having as you listen to the panel here. And we're going to go around and say our names again. You're listening to KHSU. I'm Danielle Orr.
Thank you. Renee Saucedo.
Jill Larrabee.
Zira Starchild.
Maya.
The something that Sarah had said about the dominant culture only being able to imagine that if, I guess, another race took over, that they would be dominated. And it strikes me that it is so old paradigm. And I guess it's just my perception of reality and my belief system that we are actually living in a new age, in a new paradigm. And that patriarchal perception that power is about power over others and dominion over others is where that idea comes from. There's a saying I love that a man cannot see beyond his own choices. So if someone is in that dominion of others mindset, that is the only way they can perceive power. So I guess if they hear people of color saying, we want power, they interpret that's power over them. And that is the irony, because at least the people I know who are asking for power are more talking about empowerment. We're talking about equality. Equality doesn't mean I'm greater than you and I need to dominate you. This is a new paradigm. And I would like to just put that out to the listeners, that every year we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday and we talk about his dream. And to be honest, as you know, 50-something woman now who've heard that story all my life, I feel like that is so last century. Okay, we're in the 21st century now. It's time for a new dream. And to my mind, true racial equality is the same as true human equality. The idea that we are all a part of one family, if you were literally a mother of 10 children and you treated some of those children better and they got more resources and they got better clothes and they got better food than the other, you would be a crappy parent. And everybody would agree on that. So, and yet we have a society that is structured that way. And rather than be defensive about it or you know, point fingers at people of who created this dysfunctional system that we're all in, you know what? It's baked, it's in, it's done. And I would love to say that's so last century. But you know what? We're in the 21st century. We can create a new dream. And I think now is the time for that dream. I prefer, rather than equity, the term equality, because that idea that we are somehow not equal is baked into that own system of dominion. It's really this idea of a hierarchy where there has to be somebody on top and there have to be people below them. I really do think that it is possible to, just as in a family, you can structure things where different people have different responsibilities. And maybe the one-year-old is not gonna have a lot of responsibilities, but that one-year-old is not seen as less than because they can't do the same thing that the 19-year-old can do. They're all, as a family, seen as equally valued as human beings. That is where racism tears us all apart, because it implies that some human lives have more value than other human lives. And there really is no logic to that. And I think that's where racism becomes an uncomfortable thing for white people, because, you know, there's always going to be the blatant racist who will say that, but most won't say that because it's ridiculous. It sounds just asinine to actually say something like that. But our system is based on that idea. Again, the founding fathers were slave owners. And in the Constitution, it was written in that a black person was 3/5 of a human being. It is not just a cultural thing. That was literally in the psyche of the founding fathers. And we cannot help but in our modern day era continue that without talking about it, without bringing it into the light. Since I have lived in this community 20 years, I'm amazed at how just in the last year, just by getting to know indigenous people, how much more I've learned about the true history of this region. Partly because it's not taught to this day in the public school system. Now, that's a perfect example of institutional racism. Why is it that you can send your kid to school and they can graduate still having no knowledge that a massacre happened right in this region? That's not a choice of the past. That is a current choice that whoever is setting the California curriculum is choosing still to edit that truth out of our so-called educational system. Why? Because it certainly implies to me that those people who were murdered, their lives don't matter. At least we talk about the Holocaust and acknowledge that those people were murdered and that their lives mattered. But I don't really see a difference between the Holocaust and the genocide of Native Americans. But it's not even in our history books still. Why?
I know you have something to say about that.
Well, I'm thinking about this, and this sounds a little trivial right now. There was a movie that came out maybe last year, Hidden Figures. And everyone was so happy to see the movie. Everyone was all excited about it. And I just remember leaving so angry that that was kept from me. That growing up as a Black girl, thinking that only white boys did science and math, that only white people were smart in these areas, not knowing that, wow, my race contributed. We weren't just slaves. So in my history classes in school, we had a line, indentured servants or slavery. And that was it, as if we had nothing else to contribute. That really ruins the self-esteem of Black and brown children in this country when you don't see your own self in the history books. You don't see your people's contribution. Yeah. I think that's intentional, not that I think about it.
Yeah. Well, and not to go too far off on intentionality, but when we're talking about education and the education system in the United States and Common Core and books, if you do research into it and you start seeing who is running a standardized tests and who is writing the school books, they're owned by the same corporation and they are funded by, you know, the right wing. Actually, it has even affected nurses and how they are treating women of color. In one of the books, it's written by Pearson Corporation. They're terrible. It says that Black people have a low threshold for pain in the nursing book. So, I mean, when we're talking about all of these things and we're talking about structure and we're talking about, I am a white person, so I get to say it, we are easily programmed and we don't question because it's easy. And so we'll live in the fear, we will validate and justify, but if you just want to think about something and do a little bit of research, you will see and you'll open up that onion and the layers will come and you'll have more of an idea of really how this is organized against us, all of us, you know, especially people of color, especially women of color, especially children of color, and people who care about people of color. So, yeah.
Well, and you see it globally still, women, children, and especially women and children are still enslaved, and there's horrible things going on in the world.
Let's face it, it feeds capitalism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because if you can devalue a person, mm-hmm. you can devalue their labor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from a capitalistic point of view, there's an advantage to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The paradigm shift that she's talking about, it is happening. The younger generation, there's more white kids who are getting this, and they are there, and they're ready, they're angry, and it's happening. The tide is changing. And I know that has to be the thing, or else I don't know what we're here for. Yeah. But I'm here for these women. Yeah. We're going to do something.
And I think it's an odd thing that in this community, I've lived here 20 years, and I understand what Sarah was talking about of just sort of keeping your head down and moving along and not really ever bringing up racism because you're sort of trained as a person of color that that makes the white people in the room uncomfortable. So you never really talk about this. And there was something about Josiah Lawson's death, his case, the story, how it's affected people, that I swear this was probably inevitable anyway, but he is the tipping point. I really do believe that for this community.
I just wanted to touch really quick because it was just brought up about, you know, the youth being angry. And I think that it's important to kind of define that a little bit because I know that a lot of the time I'll hear when I would like argue a point or try to talk about something instantly, you know, I don't know if it's just because I'm a female or if, you know, it has to do with I'm a indigenous person, you know, but there's something there where they instantly label you as emotionally unstable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
So, like, you're angry, you're upset. Mm-hmm. We hear that you're upset. Like, that just kind of keeps getting thrown in my face. And I got it in front of Trinidad City Council quite a bit, especially when I first started because I was in my late 20s. And so being young, being a woman, you know, I'm standing up there and I'm just reading policies and laws. There is nothing more dry in the world than sitting there reading off policies and laws, objecting to, you know, a project that would damage our cultural sites. And I would get feedback instantly of, well, we recognize that you're upset. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just reading these policies. You know, there was no emotion to it. You know, like when I would present things in court, it's very, very dry. And it was instantly talking about my emotions and my instability. And I still get that now, you know, and I'm a lot more direct after Josiah Lawson's murder, because I think that we can't dance around that subject anymore. It's not about projects. It's not about, you know, a store having a high theft rate or something, and so now they're following all people around. No, it's about racism, you know. I just instantly would start addressing it as racism, because we need to acknowledge it in the community. And instantly it's like, well, why are you so angry? Well, I'm not actually angry. And so, Zira, you actually said something that I found really, really insightful. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you talked about righteous anger. And I was hoping that maybe you could do that again.
Yeah, that was interesting. Well, the NAACP sponsored the showing of a movie that was done, a documentary by a Sacramento State University student on the Josiah Lawson murder and the aftermath and how it's affected the community. And the NAACP, with Jill very much spearheading that with Tina Sampe, put that on the big screen at the Dree Street Community Center, and we made it a free event, and more than 100 people came out for that. And afterwards, we just passed a mic around and let people share their feelings about what they saw and what they're feeling. There were many, many students of color there, but there were a lot of white people there as well. And one white man spoke and said something about how, I think it was like maybe after Martin Luther King was shot, that some black boys beat him up at his high school. And for some reason, he felt the need to share that story with us. And it was interesting because I sort of noticed I was the mic handler, you know, so I sort of could sort of feel the room was so, like, you know, healing and cathartic up until that point. And I'm sure he did not mean to deflate the energy, but I could feel it kind of going down. So I sort of just took the mic back and I said, I understand what you're saying. Because what he was saying was, you know, I understand these people were mad, but I don't feel like I should have been treated that way. Well, no, of course you shouldn't have been beat up. But I said, there is such a thing as righteous anger. That is where you know that you have been treated unfairly, oppressed by not just individuals, by an entire system that is institutionalized oppression. And we are now moving into a different century, the 21st century. We are solidly in it now, and we have to accept things from the last century that we do not want to bring with us. And that sort of institutionalized racism is not something that should be a part of our system. Like I say, I think racism is as much a psychological issue as it is a societal issue, but it starts with the psychology. And this is where it's super important here to realize this, that if we are going to get together as a group of folks and talk about racism on this topic, we cannot actually be on the same page. It's just not possible.
Not only have we been duped, but I think when you're talking about this paradigm shift moving forward, when someone tells you about their experience, you don't have to fix it. Yes. You just have to believe them.
Yes.
We don't need you to create some alternative. Oh, you must be crazy. Oh, you must be wrong. No, just believe what I say. When I first moved here and I was telling people about the police following me and how uncomfortable that made me feel, but I was used to it. You can still be scared and used to something at the same time. Oh, no, that was probably... And I would just cut them off because I thought, now I know you're not safe. When I first moved to Ferndale, I was followed a few times, not in a store, but on the highway by cops. And I learned growing up that as a woman, you drive until you see something well lit before you pull over. So not lights on, just being followed. And so I got off on the exit and the cop just went the other way, got back on the road, but tailgated me all the way until I got off the highway. It's nighttime, it's dark. Anyway, it's a very scary experience. And that's just that horrible experience of interacting with the police. And it's mostly intimidation, of course, but you're not welcome here.
I think we brought up righteous anger. Yeah. So go,
righteous anger, you know, just... I'm not imagining it. I know what it looks like when I show up for an open house and I get an energy that you are not welcome here. Mm-hmm. And so the two places I've lived here have only been because I was spoken for, if that makes any sense.
Somebody called you back and gave you a chance to rent.
Yeah. Because someone white had spoken for me, right? So it wasn't, oh, we have this place available for you. No, it was someone said that you were not like whatever we thought Black people were like, and so you must be safe. And I don't think that's what people mean when they say housing is scarce. I was on my way to a meeting here at HSU, and I'm coming out of Starbucks, and it's sunny. I have my tea. I'm excited. And someone leans out of their car and yells the N-word. And unbeknownst to others at the meeting that I'm going to, that's how my day started. But I'm still expected to sit in this meeting and be productive and be calm and not be the angry Black woman and so on and so forth. And I sit there and I think about how unfair it is that you can go through your life eating cereal in the morning and coming to work and talking about the sports game. And I'm just thinking, someone just called me the N-word. But I still have to pretend that that didn't happen. And I know not to tell them about it because they're going to say, no, that's probably not what he said.
Yeah.
This
is a forum where I feel like the white folks listening need to know that this is our experience. And it's not just in Humboldt County. I had one guy say to me, you know, if it's so racist in Humboldt, why don't you move? Well, because there's nowhere in the United States of America where you can escape this. Okay. And unlike people like Renee, where they'll throw the, you know, you should just go back to Mexico. Well, we can't go back to Africa. I have no idea other than the continent of Africa where my people come from. And I will never know that.
We're turning the mic to Jill and then Sarah, if you have any other comments.
I want people of color to know that their emotions, whatever range they are always valid and valued and heard. There's got to be some change. This system's broken. There's no amending this Constitution. The Constitution still says 3/5. This Constitution does not say anything about women. And I bet, I don't know for a fact, there's nothing about Native people in the Constitution.
I got to say one thing. Violence never solves anything. What I meant by righteous anger is that you take that fire in your soul of knowing an injustice has happened and you find a way to do some constructive good. But if you turn to violence, never let anyone make you sink down into your own darkness, because that's what violence is. And that is what those who are on top of this system that want to hold others down through oppression, that's what they want. They want us to become violent, because as soon as we do, they say, see, this is why we have to control them.
Yeah.
So I do believe that that is why Martin Luther King's message did last and why Gandhi's message did last, because they understood that as much as we need that righteous anger to fuel us to fight for freedom, we can never let ourselves succumb to violence. And it's not so much just about hurting somebody else, but once you go into that dark pit, you are stained for life. So there is a greater power, and I do believe the access through it is love. And I do believe it's not a quick fix, but, you know, somebody asked earlier, you know, what is the answer to racism? It's love. I think opening our hearts is the answer, and listening to each other.
Sarah, comments?
I think I'd like to just, you know, finish up by saying that for allies of people of color, indigenous people, I would just ask that when somebody tells you that something is happening to them like that, please listen and then use your voice to go out and help change that, dismantle that supremacy that's happening.
And on that note, we're going to wrap up this program, and I bet we'll have more like it on KHSU in maybe months to follow. Sarah, please tell the listeners your name, and I really thank you for joining us on the phone today.
My name is Sarah Lindgren-Akana.
Thank you again, Sarah. And thank you, Jill. Please tell the listeners who you are.
Jill Larrabee.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Zira Starchild.
Zira, thank you.
Maya.
Thank you, Maya, for joining us.
Thank you.
Been listening to KHSU, and we've just been sitting around a table and on a telephone chatting about a pretty intense dynamic that really doesn't serve anybody anymore.